welcome everybody to the February Citizens Climate Lobby call. In just a minute, I'll be introducing our guest, Jeff O'Malley, whose voice you just heard. Before we do that, I do want to welcome those of you who are from New Chapters. We started several new chapters in North America since last month's call, and in particular, I wanted to welcome the new group in Detroit because I know that they paused their group launch workshop a few minutes ago so they could join the call. Detroit, it's great to have you on. I don't know if you know this. You probably don't, but I lived in Detroit in 1978, 1979. I loved it there. When my company said they were transferring me to San Diego, I cried like a baby, and people said, what's wrong with you? You're going to San Diego. And for me, where you are is always about the people, and the people in Detroit were so great, and I still have really, really dear friends. So in particular, welcome, Detroit. So what's going to happen is we'll have our guest from UNICEF. I think this is such an important piece for us in a couple of minutes. And then we're going to reverse the order of the way we do things sometimes. Usually what we do is go over reports from the field and then go over the actions, but actually we're going to do the actions first and then some reports from the field. And in addition to that, we'll have an update from our legislative director on a few things like, you know, the Supreme Court decision on the Clean Power Plan. So lot to cover in not a ton of time. Now, Jeff, I do want to tell you a little bit about the people that you're speaking to before I introduce you. These are simply the most unreasonable people that I have ever met or worked with. And I don't mean unreasonable like difficult. I mean unreasonable like unwilling to give up. And I want to just give you two examples from this week. So for 2.5 years, Jay Butera and some of our Florida volunteers have been working on trying to get Democrats and Republicans to work together, and particularly starting in Florida, because Florida is ground zero for climate change in the U.S. And this week we announced the beginning of the Bipartisan Climate Solution Caucus that's chaired by a Republican and a Democrat. Now, during that whole 2.5 year period, people told us, you know, you can't get Republican leadership on this issue, even though we've now got 13 Republican co-sponsors on the Gibson resolution, that you couldn't get people to work together with this Congress, but they just kept going. So when I say unreasonable, I mean that kind of unreasonable. And then I want to point to one other example from this week. So some of our volunteers went to a talk in New York that was held by Paul Krugman, the Nobel laureate and op-ed writer for the New York Times. And at the end of his talk, Ashley made sure she was the first person in line, and she walked up and said, you know, hi, Mr. Krugman, I work for Citizens Climate Lobby. Are you familiar with us? And he said, yes, I do notice that I get a lot of letters from the editor from Citizens Climate Lobby from the op-eds that I write, which delighted me to know that he saw all those. But then Lynn Meyer, who was also with Ashley, handed him an introductory flyer and said, you know, I think you really ought to join one of Citizens Climate Lobby's introductory calls. And I just love the fact that here's a Nobel laureate, and here's what our volunteer is saying. You know, I think the best thing you could do with your time is joining our weekly introductory call. So the people you're talking to, they've never been stopped by what they think they ought to do or what they could do. They just are way too busy trying to get done what needs to get done. So just a little bit about them. So let me tell you a little bit about our speaker. Jeff O'Malley is the director of the Division of Data, Research, and Policy for UNICEF, based in New York. In that role, he's responsible for shaping research and evidence priorities for the organization, ensuring that evidence in turn shapes UNICEF policies and strategies, and leading UNICEF corporate planning and accountability. A little bit prior to that, Jeff's background includes director of HIV, Health and Development for UNDP, and the county director for India for PATH, the Program for Appropriate Technology and Health. Between 1993 and 2004, Mr. O'Malley established and led the International HIV-AIDS Alliance, amazing, right, which became the world's largest international development non-governmental organization specializing in HIV and AIDS. He has also worked for the Harvard School of Public Health and the World Health Organization. And obviously we've always been fans of this organization, but when we saw their piece, Unless We Act Now, and the importance that UNICEF saw of acting on climate change, that just increased our desire to have someone on the call. So, Jeff, thank you so much for making yourself available on Saturday, and welcome to the call.
Thanks, Mark, and thanks for the invitation and opportunity to talk to all of you. Mark encouraged me to dial in a few minutes early, I think to make sure I was going to be on the call. But it also meant I heard all of you dialing in and all of those beeps and all of those numbers, and it's incredibly impressive. And good morning or good afternoon to all of you, and good afternoon to Paul Krugman if you've dialed in. Thanks to Ashley. It's really important to be having the opportunity to talk to you today. Just a few weeks ago, I learned from Mark about Marshall Saunders and his work for many years on poverty and hunger and how that led to him setting up the Citizens Climate Lobby. And Marshall's embrace of action on climate change, I think, as if I understand correctly, as an outgrowth of his fight against poverty and hunger, really resonates with what's happening in UNICEF right now. As many of you probably know, we work around the world for children's rights, survival, development, and protection. We're part of the larger United Nations system, but we're unusual as part of the UN because we also work a lot with NGOs and with volunteers in most countries around the world. And this year is our 70th anniversary, and of course lots has changed over the decades, but one constant focus for us is concretely improving the lives of the world's most disadvantaged children. My predecessors have played really important roles working with volunteers and activists around the world in a broad range of important movements for children, from the dramatic increases in child survival driven by vaccines and immunization to achievement of almost universal enrollment of girls and boys in primary school, to the ongoing struggle to protect children from armed conflicts as victims or as combatants. And with that history of focusing on important issues for the world's most disadvantaged children and to achieving concrete results, you won't be surprised we now realize we need to dramatically step up our own engagement in climate change. As all of you know probably much better than I do, climate change is not only one of the greatest challenges of our generation, it will continue to be so for future generations. And as the report's title suggests, what we do now to prevent and adapt to that challenge will make a huge difference to the type of world our children will live in. There's a clear scientific consensus that climate change will increase the frequency of droughts, floods, and severe weather events. Each of these threats poses grave risks for children over the coming decades. Severe weather events can destroy or disrupt infrastructure critical to child well-being, including schools, health facilities, and transport systems. Droughts and flooding can destroy crops, disrupt water systems, and contaminate water reserves. The UNICEF report examines how many children live in regions that are particularly at risk from the impact of climate change. We found that over 500 million children already today live in extremely high flood occurrence zones, and nearly 160 million live in high or extremely high drought severity zones. While climate change will ultimately impact every child, it's these children that are already in harm's way and face some of the most immediate risks. And climate change is likely to magnify the scale of these impacts in the future. The report also outlines how climate change will undermine other development gains and livelihood options over a longer period of time. Climate change will contribute to rising temperatures and changing rainfall patterns, which in turn are likely to exacerbate the spread of vector-borne diseases such as malaria, Zika, and dengue. Dwindling water supplies and resource scarcity will likely increase migratory pressures on vulnerable families, disrupting livelihoods and increasing the risk of family displacement. One of the report's main messages is that the dangers of climate change are more pronounced for children than for adults. Children are more vulnerable to vector-borne diseases. They face greater dangers from undernutrition and diarrheal diseases. The physical dangers of extreme weather events, flooding, building collapse, and more, pose unique threats to young bodies and minds. Many of the same emissions that drive climate change, for example, from coal-fired electricity or traditional cars, also drive air pollution, and young children breathe at twice the rate of adults. In polluted environments, their risk of respiratory infections such as pneumonia or conditions such as asthma is likely to be far higher than for adults. If, as expected, climate change worsens each of these risks, it is children who will suffer the most. Children will also feel these effects longer than adults, making them vital in today's decisions about how to respond to climate change. Another important message in the report is that climate change will make existing inequities even worse. Climate change will not affect every person equally. Flood and drought zones often overlap with areas of high poverty and low access to essential services. This means that the children and families who are already disadvantaged by poverty, those with the fewest resources for coping, are the same children who are likely to face some of the most immediate dangers of climate change. This can create a vicious cycle. A child living in poverty or deprived of adequate water and sanitation before a crisis will be more affected by a flood, drought, or storm, less likely to recover quickly, and at even greater risk in a subsequent crisis. While climate change poses threats to all of us, tackling it is an imperative for equity. Unaddressed, climate change will harm the poorest and most vulnerable children first, hardest, and longest. The report's final message is that the trajectory of climate change can and must be interrupted. As you all well know, climate change science indicates that because of past and ongoing greenhouse gas emissions, the world's climate is already changing. It is imperative that we prepare for impacts that are already inevitable. There is nevertheless an opportunity for action that can still stave off some of the worst effects of climate change. What the world does now to cut greenhouse gas emissions can dramatically reduce the number of children threatened by the most severe impacts of climate change and face some of the most immediate risks. Now is the time for action, and we depend on activists like you. The world must embark on low-carbon development to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and needs to adapt to the impacts of climate change that cannot be halted. It can take steps now to safeguard our children's future, notably cutting greenhouse gas emissions so the average rise in global temperature is limited to a maximum of 2 degrees Celsius and ideally, of course, to 1.5 degrees Celsius. Your policy focus on a carbon fee and dividend is a very promising approach to help drive this change. There are many other policy actions that are needed as well. I don't have time to go into too much detail, but UNICEF thinks it's important to prioritize the needs of the most vulnerable in climate change adaptation efforts, particularly children, who will bear the brunt of climate change far longer than adults. We believe that it's important to listen to and act on children's perspectives on climate change and involve them in the fight against these threats. It's important to protect children and their families who are forced to move as a result of climate change. And finally, it's important to invest in children as part of national climate change plans on mitigation and adaptation. Children deserve to live in a world free from the life-threatening effects of climate change. Given the overwhelming scientific evidence on the dangers and the clear opportunities we have for altering its course, there's no excuse for not acting ambitiously. Let me end by thanking all of you, because what you do as activists, individually and collectively, is absolutely essential for the realization of children's human rights around the world. Thanks very much, Mark, and thanks very much, all of you.
Wow. Jeff, just so everybody knows, Jeff sent me his remarks in advance, and I read them a few times, but it's even harder just hearing you say it out loud. So I'm just thank you for your extraordinary work and all the things you're doing to try and help the poorest of the poor people around the world. So let's see if we can get to the few of the questions that were sent most frequently to me, starting with, you know, we find that in terms of communicating with people, oftentimes the more specific and more detail we can get into makes it real to the people we're talking to. So can you just point to some of the specific countries and regions in particular countries that you're looking at where you think that there are children that are most in jeopardy?
Sure, Mark. And, you know, you just mentioned Florida as ground zero for climate change here in the United States. And of course, around the world, places that share some of that kind of geography are also at ground zero. UNICEF, of course, were particularly concerned about places that both have that physical risk, but also large numbers of poor and vulnerable children. Very dramatic examples are Bangladesh and Philippines, both which have very high populations of children, but they're also extremely prone to flood and weather-related disasters. The Horn of Africa and parts of Pakistan and northern India also have high populations of children, and for them, they've all experienced already severe droughts in recent years. We're also very concerned about small island developing states. Countries like the Maldives in South Asia, Kiribati in the Pacific, they're already experiencing climate change as an existential threat today's children and future generations in those places really have no future unless they migrate. So there's really a pretty broad range of places around the world that we can add to the list on top of Florida.
Okay, yeah, thank you. And, you know, we have groups throughout the world, but over 90% of our chapters, active chapters, are in North America right now. And so, you know, how can you help us bring this home to people when this seems so far away? You know, it's, you know, in Florida, we are, one of the reasons we're getting so much traction is because at high tide, the ocean is washing back in through the sewer and filling the streets of Miami. But, you know, for distant countries where it seems so far away, it doesn't seem immediate, what are the things that we can do to make that real for the people we're speaking with?
Look, that's an incredibly important question if we're ever going to have the action we need. Look, let me start on a bit of a tangent. The reason UNICEF is talking about climate change is not because we're a climate change organization. We're talking about climate change because we're a child rights organization, and we realize climate change is going to be particularly harmful to children. That's why we've put out this report. That's why we've joined all of you. But I mention this because focusing on the threat to children isn't just to help children. Over and over again, what I've experienced is focusing on the threat to children helps to draw attention to other issues. So focusing on climate change in general or abstract issues like the difference between 1.5 degrees and 2 degrees Celsius, it can be quite hard to motivate people. But focusing on kids and kids who are vulnerable and the right of kids to grow up and learn and to live and to play and to become productive adults, no matter what the issue is, there are very few people in the world, at least, who will admit that they don't care about children. So here in North America, what we've seen again and again is that North Americans, ordinary people and politicians, have again and again been really generous in their response to children, you know, on global immunization programs, on education, on the importance of protecting children from war. And I think that drawing attention to kids as part of your climate change message can really help bring it home.
Yeah, boy, I think you're so right on. I guarantee you the people who are listening are just gobbling this up. Okay, and then in particular, you know, climate refugees, where are the places where you're looking at people being disrupted? I know you mentioned some, but if you would speak to that a little bit more, I that's an area that we're very concerned about.
Look, we need about 4 hours to talk about Syria. But the war in Syria and its effects, you know, all over the region is not primarily caused by climate change. It's caused by many other factors. But we have no doubt that climate change is exacerbating that conflict. There have been a series of droughts in the years leading up to the war, up to 5 years ago, which were far more frequent and severe than the normal pattern of droughts in Syria. Those droughts, in turn, exacerbated the importance of land grabs. It exacerbated people's vulnerability, their poverty, and the other factors that sparked and have driven that war have undoubtedly been made worse by those droughts, by the effects of climate change we're already seeing. Similarly, in the Horn of Africa, in Somalia and neighboring countries. So although climate change alone isn't causing these refugees yet, it's already exacerbating these problems, and increasingly in the future, I think it's going to be the primary cause. And where we're going to see that first is in low-lying areas, in coastal areas and low-lying islands.
Okay, good. And then the other question that was submitted to me quite often, it was about, you know, how have you or how can we leverage the Pope's encyclical? Certainly his speech to Congress was remarkable. In our case, what we did is we hand-delivered a copy of the encyclical to every office in advance of his speech, saying, you know, we think that familiarizing yourself with these comments will help you in being able to answer questions. And it was really interesting. I got some really lovely notes back from members of Congress. None of them were Catholic. They were all evangelical. But a lot of the evangelicals seemed extremely touched by us putting that in their hands. So can you just talk about how you've been able to use that and how you think we could leverage that also?
Listen, I think it was an incredibly powerful and important document. And In fact, one of the things I did early last year at UNICEF headquarters in New York is I invited the bishop who chaired the writing committee for the encyclical. I invited him to UNICEF to present the findings of his research and the content of the encyclical to my team and to UNICEF staff. And I did that because it was important for me to sensitize my colleagues and help them understand why this issue mattered for children. And taking advantage of the encyclical, you know, to help catalyze and drive that conversation in UNICEF, I think really helped build momentum for our action last year. So just to say that I agree with you that it's really an important tactic. And I think that it's reflected in what we call the Sustainable Development Goals. I don't know how many people are familiar with those, but the countries of the world and the United Nations recently gathered and they committed themselves to this set of global goals, which predated, it was immediately before the COP21 agreement in Paris. And I think the ideas in the encyclical are really strongly reflected in those goals. The importance of climate change, but also how it's so interwoven with other issues of poverty, rights, and dignity. So I just say use it as much as you can. It does, as you said, speak not just to Catholics, but to evangelical Christians, and frankly, it speaks to people of all faith groups around the world.
Yeah, great. So, you know, you're correct that, you know, we actually came to climate through poverty, and, you know, Marshall had spent so much time setting up microcredit loans around the world. There's a statement he has on the inside of his door that stops me every time I read it, from Mahatma Gandhi, and he says, "Whenever you're in doubt, apply the first test. Recall the face of the poorest or the weakest man whom you may have seen and ask yourself if the step you're contemplating is going to be any use to him. Will he gain anything from it? Will it restore him to control over his own life and destiny? True development puts those that society puts last first." So, boy, it's just such a privilege for us to have someone who's doing that kind of work on the call. Jeff, thank you so much for making yourself available today.
Look, thank you, Mark, and good luck to all of you. And once again, thanks to all of you, especially to those in that newest chapter in Detroit.
Great, thank you. You're welcome to stay on for the second half of the call, but if you have to drop off, we'll certainly understand.
Great, thanks all.
Okay, thank you so much. Okay, so I have a few people that I need to make a few announcements. I told you that Danny Richter, our legislative director, at the end of the call is going to talk about the Supreme Court decision with the Clean Power Plan. And I want to get to some other things. So I'm going to bring Steve Volk on, then Kathy, then Amy, then Danny. So I'm going to have Steve Volk talk about our letter and op-ed campaign, because what we're asking the chapters in the U.S. to do is to write letters to the editor and op-eds about the House Climate Solutions Caucus. Now, one of the reasons I want Steve to come on for a minute is I think Steve's done a phenomenal job of training all of us on getting published so often, you know, over 3,000 letters to the editor last year, over 500 op-eds, because we've gotten very good at responding to what the paper says is news. In this case, most newspapers aren't going to report on this unless we do. So how do we generate letters to the editor and op-eds when the newspaper is not saying that? Let me just say one other thing about the Bipartisan Climate Caucus, Solution Caucus. They are not asking us to help them build this yet. So we do not want you to go to your member Congress at this point and ask to join this caucus. They want to build it one Republican, one Democrat at a time, so that there's a pair in each case. It's just like Noah's Ark. And they want to be careful about the beginning of who's in there initially. So at this point, we're not asking you to reach out to your member Congress, but we do want you to write letters to the editor and op-eds. The other thing we're going to be doing in the U.S. is starting to do our plans, if not already in work, for Earth Week. That is always our biggest organizing opportunity, and so we want to make sure that we all are doing everything we can to develop outreach events. We're assuming, obviously, that in addition to scheduling appointments for the lobby drive, that you're organizing your teams and doing all that work, but we didn't list it as one of the actions. We thought it was just kind of an of course. So, Steve, could you just come on for a minute and talk about how do we get published if the newspaper is not reporting the Bipartisan Solutions Caucus what can we do to make sure we're still getting published a lot on it?
Great. Can you hear me, Mark?
Yes, Steve, go ahead.
Wonderful. Okay, great. So if this story is not going to appear in your newspaper, how do you get a letter to the editor published about it? Well, the thing to do is to find something that's in the newspaper that is in the news and relate it then to the thing that you want to talk about. And I'll give you an example of that. The Zika virus has been very much in the news. And so here's an example of a letter that might open talking about the Zika virus and then transitioning into the Climate Solutions Caucus. So here's the example. The growing emergency of the Zika virus, which has been linked to a debilitating birth defect, is one more symptom of a sick climate. As the planet warms, the range of the mosquitoes that carry this virus increases, becoming a threat in places where diseases like this never existed. Unless we limit the risks of climate change by reducing our greenhouse gas emissions, we will see more of this in our future. So we've done a couple of things here. We opened the letter by referencing something in the news, and we've made the connection to climate change. Now, here's where we pivot. Fortunately, the chances that our nation will take effective action on climate change have increased dramatically with the recent creation of the bipartisan Climate Solutions Caucus in the House of Representatives, led by Representative Carlos Curbelo and Representative Ted Deutsch, both of Florida. This new caucus will finally bring both Republicans and Democrats to the table to develop national policies aimed at preserving a livable world for future generations. Okay, so after we mention the caucus, we need to wrap up the letter. And it's good if we can circle back to the beginning, but also tie into the climate caucus. So here's the ending on it. The Zika virus is a reminder of the unforeseen consequences we have unleashed with carbon pollution. The Climate Solutions Caucus, however, offers the hope that we can prevent these consequences from spiraling out of control. So this example is in your action sheet. And as a matter of fact, I submitted this letter to the AJC, the Journal Constitution here in Atlanta, this past week, and they called me up on Thursday and they said that they're going to be running it on Sunday. So this is a good way to get those letters published about the Climate Solutions Caucus. And we want to track that, too, because we want to do exactly the same thing with the Climate Solutions Caucus that we did with the Gibson Resolution, generate a lot of media, and then show congressional offices what we're capable of doing when members of Congress step up. Mark, back to you.
Okay, Steve, thanks a lot. Okay, so again, we're going to do the U.S. actions, which are Get Ready for Earth Day, get published on the Bipartisan Solutions Caucus. Obviously, there's tons of opportunities to write about the Supreme Court ruling on the Clean Power Plan. And then let's talk about the Canadian actions, and then we're going to talk about reports from the field and have Danny give us a couple of really exciting updates. Kathy, what are we doing in Canada this month?
Hi, Mark. It's Kathy. So in Canada, we'd like for our members to review their group goals that they outlined in January and note there are additional resources to help them in this month's action sheets. We'd like for our groups to devise a plan to promote Canada's online parliamentary petition for carbon fee and dividend that we hope to launch in late February, early March, and start planning to lobby your MP after the provinces announce their climate plans in late March or in Ottawa, where we're meeting March 20th to 22nd. I'd also like to welcome Marlo, Jay, Jonathan, Tanner, and Ian to CCL Canada. CCL Vancouver was reinvigorated, and they're already producing amazing results that includes letters to the editor, lobbying within riding associations, and also lobbying their MPs. And finally, Mark, in December, Lori Goldstein, an editor at the
So, Kathy, we lost you. We'll imagine something great happened, and also congratulations to Toronto for splitting into four chapters. We'll see if we can get Kathy back for that last piece. Amy Bender, are you there?
Yes, I am, Mark. Can you hear me?
Yeah, so Amy reports our monthly reports from the field, and every month we tell you how many letters we got, how many op-eds, how many meetings with members of Congress, And I just want to tell Amy to tell people a little bit of background, or what are you looking for to make sure that when we report things, people can have a high degree of confidence that we've got that all right?
Well, what I do is at the end of every month, I go over the reports of what was published in the news, either online or in hard copies of the newspapers. And when we share our accomplishments, we want to be sure that we're as accurate as possible. So I try to check all the links that you all send in, cross-check the entries to make sure that the categories are correct. And also, you know, since our numbers are so substantial, we want to be able to stand by them. So sometimes I'll catch a letter to the editor that's actually labeled as an editorial or an op-ed, and I may find a few corrections. Or sometimes the person who submits the field reports finds something themselves when they get the automated summary right back. So they send me the field report number, and I can correct it from my end. So I really appreciate that. Because we have so many new CCL members every day, they're just learning how to submit field reports. I wanted to just clarify a couple of those categories. So an editorial is written by the editorial board or the board members of that newspaper, and that represents the newspaper's opinion on a particular issue. Now, an op-ed refers to a piece that is printed on the page opposite the editorial. I didn't know that before I came to CCL. Op-eds are usually 500 to 700 words, approximately. And a letter to the editor is usually less than 200 words, and it's usually a response to an editorial or an op-ed. For January of this year, we had 45 published op-eds and 255 published letters to the editor. And I just want to really thank you all for these successes. They're terrific. I love reading your published work, and I love seeing you build political will. Thanks so much.
Great, Amy. Thank you so much. All right, let's bring in our legislative director, Dr. Danny Richter. He's going to address the Supreme Court ruling on the Clean Power Plan and a couple of other items. So are you there, Dr. Richter?
I'm here, Mark.
All right. Welcome. Go ahead.
Okay, I have four brief items to mention this morning. First of all, the Supreme Court. Last week, the Supreme Court issued a temporary stay or halt to implementation on the Clean Power Plan. It is a temporary stay. It was a 5-4 ruling. Oral arguments in the D.C. Circuit Court begin June 2nd, so a decision could land just in time for our conference, again lending high drama to our event. But that decision will almost certainly go to the Supreme Court later on. From our perspective, this stay only underlines the importance of the work we do in pushing for a more robust legislative solution. Second item. If you're looking for inspiration as to why the Climate Solutions Caucus is so important, consider findings from a recent study highlighted by the Niskanen Center. Of five factors considered in the study, only one had an impact on the public's belief in climate change. That is, cues from elites. So, when Republican leaders decide to speak up about climate change, one can see an immediate response in the national polling data. That's because Republicans, like Democrats, play follow the leader and adjust their own opinions accordingly. When elected Republicans take a stand, as with the caucus, as with House Resolution 424, as with the Senate Energy and Environment Working Group, belief in climate change among the rank and file spikes. Third item, accreditation. Citizens Climate University, formerly known as Citizens Climate Lobby University, is approved for accreditation by the University of California. The University of California system includes some of the top-ranked universities in the country, including UC Berkeley and UCLA. What does this mean? It means that Citizens Climate Education, our 501c3 organization, may very well be the first climate advocacy organization to receive accreditation by a major university. It will not be for college-level credit, but for quote-unquote badges, certifying completion of a certain skill. Andy Behrs and Ricky Bradley on our staff will be working over the coming months to establish tracks of CCU webinars for which a badge might be earned. Such badges will likely be most useful for people applying for jobs, as it will signify a specific skill gained. Since we are not aware of any advocacy organization that has such an arrangement, it is unclear what this will mean for us. But we're thinking big. We think it will be good for attracting and retaining millennials, for local outreach to high schools, community colleges, and universities, certainly for distinguishing CCE from CCL, and for writing grants so we can continue to support the work that you do. Fourth item, how are we picking laser talks this year? This month, we picked some of the very basic laser talks about a proposal. In the coming months, we will be supplying talks that answer the top questions asked by members of Congress, so you are well prepared to answer the questions you are most likely to get. This analysis is based on my survey of the 487 sets of meeting notes from June 2015. So we're going to be systematic about this, not willy-nilly. Each of the six topics we'll be picking laser talks for came up in at least 10% of all meetings. So by studying them, you'll have a better than 1 in 10 chance that any given office you will meet in June will bring up that particular topic. Mark, back to you.
Great, Danny. Thank you so much. So, again, every month between now and the conference, you'll get more than one laser talk, and the ones you're going to be getting are the ones that came up most frequently. There will be other ones we'll want you to learn, but we'll add emphasis to. These are the things that come up all the time with congressional offices, so those are areas that we want to be particularly strong. Okay, a couple things that I want to mention since last month's call. In addition to the bipartisan climate caucus forming, also the 13th sponsor for the Gibson Resolution came on. Los Angeles had the biggest regional conference that we've ever had. The regional conference in Austin was twice as big as the one the previous year. Georgia had its own state congress. Sohoy and everybody, congratulations on that. We started another Train the Trainer program. We doubled the people who are going to be trained to do our basic group start program. And so that represents now 37 states and 4 countries where people are trained or have been trained. And then I just want to tell everybody who's working on the endorser project, you're doing phenomenal work. So we're getting lots of people from mayors and city councils and places like that, so I think that that's great. And then some really fun ones, like Bill Nye, the science guy. Congratulations to Rob and the Pasadena chapter to getting Bill Nye on there. Mars, the people who make candy bars, Aspen Ski. So, you know, in addition to a lot of the local people, there are also some fun national ones, and thank you for everybody who's doing that. Okay, then the last thing I want to say is that I think that this year's conference is going to be our most important conference. You know, we've essentially been selling Congress a concept for the last 7 years. What we've been saying is Republicans will take leadership on this issue, and everybody's told us we're crazy. And we say, no, 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 Republicans will take leadership on this issue, and people say, no, no, it can't happen. You can't happen. Well, there's 13 people on the Gibson Resolution now. And we've been saying that Republicans and Democrats will work together. And, again, you know, the party line everybody has is it's too partisan, you know, Washington's too screwed up. But nevertheless, in addition to going in and talking about that, we're going to be able to show evidence for what we've been saying could happen for a long time. So I think that that makes something available at this year's conference that's never been available, and it will probably end up being our most important conference ever. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to unmute the lines, and if you want to thank our guest from UNICEF, Jeff, let me see if I can read that statement from Marshall's office again. I kind of struggled through that the first time because I think this really speaks to UNICEF. This is from Gandhi. He says, whenever you're in doubt, apply the first test. Recall the face of the poorest or the weakest man whom you may have seen and ask yourself if the step you contemplate is going to be of any use to him. Will he gain anything from it? Will it restore him to control over his own life and destiny? True development puts first those that society puts last.